This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with cartoonist Mike Dawson. Thanks for listening to iFanboys Talksplode, the interview show from iFanboy.com. I am Josh Flanagan. Today we're going to talk with Mike Dawson, cartoonist and creator of Freddy and Me, Jack and Max, Gabagool, and Ace Face, the mod with the metal arms, and also host of the Ink Panthers podcast with Alex Robinson. Hey, I am here with comic creator Mike Dawson. How are you doing today?
Doing very well, thank you.
Very good. Mike, you were first known to us at iFanboy when Freddy and Me got made Book of the Month sometime last year.
Yeah.
And I had heard rumblings about it, and I thought that's an interesting book, and then never got around to picking it up for a long time, which is, I imagine, the bane of indie comics creators.
No, I understand. It's 300 pages. I don't expect people to immediately go out and pick it up and devour it. When they become aware of it, eventually they'll come to it.
Now, I guess, why don't you describe what the book is? I mean, would you call it a memoir?
Yes, a graphic memoir. It was published in the summer of 2008 by Bloomsbury. It's called Freddy and Me, A Coming-of-Age Bohemian Rhapsody. And it is a graphic memoir about my lifelong childhood obsession with Freddie Mercury and Queen. It tells the story of my family moving from the UK to America when I was a preteen, a tween.
They didn't have that term back then.
They did not. I never said, I'm a tween.
I imagine was, no one does that.
That was my
now.
British accent just then. Yeah. Yes. Oi, I'm a tween. No, I bet they probably don't actually do that. I don't know. I don't know if 11-year-olds say that.
I'm terrified of 11-year-olds. I couldn't tell you.
11-year-olds are all right. It's the 16-year-olds.
I can't even tell the difference. Lindsay, my wife saw a group of like kids down the road. She's like, ooh. And I was like, I think they're just kids. Oh, they look tough. And I was like, I think it's just what kids look like now.
You didn't keep your eyes on the pavement as you walk past? You didn't keep your eye? Don't make eye contact. They're like chimpanzees.
Yeah, that's terrible. I guess when did you decide?
Was that a good enough description of the book? That was.
We're gonna go further.
Okay, let's go further. Let's dive deep.
I guess when did you decide that this was like a story that you wanted to tell? Did you always mean it to be this long, or was it you just sort of started working on it, or?
Okay, so I had been making comics prior to Freddie and Me, although Freddie and Me is obviously my most high profile comic to date. Before then, I was writing humor comics with a friend of mine, the humorist Chris Radke. We'd been writing a series called Gabagool, which is a comedy comic that was fiction. But as a fan of alternative comics and the kind of work coming out of the North American comic book scene, I've always been very interested in autobiographical comics. And so I decided to take a break from working on Gabagool and do what I thought would be a fairly short autobiographical story. I thought it would be a funny thing to write about because it sort of is not a remarkable thing about me that I like this band. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of me sort of making a little bit of a joke about a topic that comes up a lot in alternative comics, is that people complain that people don't have interesting enough lives to write about. Mm-hmm. My opinion is that if a story is written well, it doesn't really matter what the actual items of, you know, the things that happen in your life. Yeah. If you can write about it well, I mean, that's because there's a lot of alternative comics that do that, where it's a fairly straightforward, mundane life. Like Joe Matt's The Poor Bastard, I think, is great. Chester Brown, I think his autobiographical comics are great, but they're not exactly, you know, remarkable lives. Anyway, so that was my starting point, and it was intended to be a much shorter thing, just a graphic novella, maybe, mm-hmm. Like 80 pages or so. But it just sort of grew and grew, and as I developed it, it sort of became a lot of me thinking about memory and the act of remembering, as well as writing this story of my life. I also came up with more playful ideas how to deal with the music in the context of the book. I structured the book like the song Bohemian Rhapsody, with three main parts that are all a little different in tone, with little bridging sections connecting them, because it is really one of my favorite songs of all time. Mm-hmm. That's how it came about.
How far along were you before you started to put together the structure in the whole thing? Because, I mean, I guess if you weren't planning for it to be that long, did that come up later? Or did they just a lot longer than you expected?
Well, the way I work is as I'm drawing and writing pages, I will do a lot of the writing as I go. And then I go back and do a lot of editing. I don't script things beforehand and work from a script. Mm-hmm. I sort of script maybe just a couple pages ahead, perhaps. But I've just never been very good at doing the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's actually a good way to work, because I think then it leaves a lot of room for inspiration and new ideas to hit you and, you know, to change the course of what you're writing. And I think it's actually, in comics, part of the writing of a comic is many, many hours spent working on just the drawing. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that, you're so sort of absorbed into what you're doing mentally that I think it's a really great place for new ideas to occur to you. So I'd actually written maybe 100 pages. I'd written basically the whole first section of the book, which is my childhood in England leading up to my family's decision to move to America. And it was at that point that I got the idea to mimic Bohemian Rhapsody with the story, because I came up with this idea for a little bridging section, which I called the guitar solo, which, because that comes in between the part where he's singing about his mother and then the operatic part. So that was like a little mini essay in comics form. And at that point, I got the idea that I was going to do it this way. And I you know, went about creating the book in that fashion.
Now, you were doing this basically on your own. I mean, had you been self-publishing the comics before that? You were self-publishing Gabagool, or was it being published by somebody?
Yeah, with the exception of a couple anthology credits, I'd never been published before. I'd self-published 6 issues of Gabagool. Well, 3 of them were mini comics, and then Chris and I upgraded to Quebecore floppies the second 3 issues of the series. But yeah, I'd been self-publishing, and I didn't really know if I was going to have the self-published Freddy and Me or not for a very long time.
So, I mean, how did you go from that to, I mean, you got published by Bloomsbury. It's a quote-unquote real publisher.
I think that a lot of quote-unquote real publishers, I think, were getting into and are still getting into the graphic novel game, because for a couple years there, in 2006, 2007, it was a really fast-growing segment of publishing, where other parts, it seemed like other areas were having a little bit of trouble. Graphic novels were growing. So I was one of the first graphic novels that Bloomsbury put out, and I think I have a brand new one out right now called Logic Comics. Mm-hmm. So I benefited, definitely benefited sort of timing-wise by the market's new interest in sort of books of this size and length and this type of subject matter. I think that, you know, I sort of was finishing the book up at kind of the right time, because when I started, that wasn't happening. What I was saying.
So how'd they get it? How'd you go from guy who's self-publishing comics to getting it in front of somebody to make the right decisions that they wanted to publish it?
I was able to get interest from French publishers. Mm-hmm. And I got an agreement with a French publisher, which then I think got me enough sort of momentum behind me that I was able to then get in touch with an agent in the U.S. who saw a home for it in the U.K. Publishing market as well. Mm-hmm. because my book is about America and England, it sort of was quite appealing to I think an English market as well. Sure. So he took interest in it, and then he was able to organize the other publishing deals that I had for the book, which was a couple of different countries, as well as coming out in the U.K. through a separate publisher than in the United States. That's Jonathan Cape, which is it came out hardcover.
So were you just, were you sending out submissions to different publishers, and like, were you sending them all over the world?
No. The French publishers got in touch with me because I had posted pages of the book on my website and then a comics blog linked to it, a very well-known comics blog. So it was seen by a publisher in France who contacted me, because I think it, you know, just on the basis that it was about Queen, was very appealing to Europeans, because they really like Queen over in France.
Are they still huge there?
They are. They're massive. They're massive. There's one of these things. There's never quite as big in the United States. So they contacted me, and that was very exciting. Then soon after that is when I started working with the agent, and then the agent has handled getting international deals.
Look at you.
Well, that doesn't mean that the next book is going to have the same situation.
It's that same thing where everybody in comics comes across their story and how they got published in like a completely different way.
Yeah.
I swear I never hear the same story, you know, twice. I've certainly never heard your version of it where you come through a French publisher first.
Very exciting. I thought it was going to get published in French before it ever got published in English.
Did you?
I was happy enough.
Pick up the phone one day and I was like, bonjour, what?
Exactly. And I don't even know what happened, but I had agreed to a publishing deal. I didn't find out for like a week later.
Wait a minute, 13 francs? This isn't worth anything.
Terrible deal.
This is awful.
That's why I don't answer the phone.
Now, as a result of this book, you've sort of became known as the Queen guy.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. In that, if I'm known as anything, is positive.
Sure.
Better than, you know, not being known as anything. I feel that the Queen aspect of the book is probably... It probably is a double-edged sword, right? Because I think a lot of people come to my book because they have a pre-existing interest of Queen. And then I think probably a lot of people don't read my book because they have a pre-existing hatred of Queen. And then there's just people in the middle who are probably just interested in alternative comics, and you know, and it is the type of story that I have found does appeal to people who could care less about the band.
So how big of a Queen fan are you to this day? For those of the listeners out there who may not know,
I think I recently decided to, I'm going to rate myself as a 7 or an 8.
Okay.
Out of 10, because I would have thought of myself as a big Queen fan before working on this book, but now I've met a lot of Queen fans who put me to shame.
I feel that way about Star Wars.
Whether you were 10 before,
I thought I was 10. A pretty big Star Wars fan, but really, I mean, I don't have a tattoo.
You're like, I've seen that movie 12 times. Yeah. I am the world's biggest Star Wars fan.
I mean, there's a certain, so you wouldn't say you're not obsessive. I don't think that comes across that way.
No, I'm not. And actually, sadly for Queen, my appreciation of their music became a lot more focused. So I worked on the book for about 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. When I started, I was just a blanket Queen fan. Just, oh, I love Queen. But after spending all those years listening to all their albums, I've started now I definitely like certain albums a lot more than others, and other ones I don't really even like at all as much anymore.
And
some of the latter day albums,
as is pretty standard.
Yeah, I mean,
the last few Who albums. You see, anyway. Now, let me ask you, I guess, something else. When you're doing an autobiocomic like that, and you're fairly expansive, how does it? Were you thinking about how you were putting a version of yourself out, and like, you know, I guess laying yourself out there a little bit? Did that come relatively naturally, or was it something you were thinking about a lot as you were doing it?
It came relatively naturally. I mean, when I think about trying to make a story from life experiences, I definitely learned early on that the way it happens in a television show like The Wonder Years, where he's able to be like, I remember this one thing that happened over the course of 1 week, and I remember it all clearly, and here's a clear narrative. It's not like that with your own memories. It's much more, you know, images here and images there, and sort of a you know, vague story that you can sort of piece together. But it definitely isn't the kind of thing where you're like, I remember specifically every event that happened over the course of those couple of days. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So I found that it really was like, the experience was in the beginning just sort of trying to compose some of those snapshots, and then the narrative grew out of that. And none of it is made up. It's all the way that I remember things, even to an extreme where certain things couldn't have happened the way I remembered it. But since I remembered it that way, that's how I wrote it. Mm-hmm. With things like when I – well.
Did you do like research about – like did you check on a story? Did you
– Yeah, well, this is the one glaring example is that my memory of Freddie Mercury announcing he had AIDS – happened on a school day, and I went to school and I was upset all day, and then the next day he died and I was really upset. But when I looked at the calendar, he announced it on a Sunday, and so I would have gone on the Monday when he died, but for some reason I have these memories of the day before, even though it definitely didn't happen at school. I remember being at school. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, it's not reliable.
Sure.
Memory is not, you know, and plus the people who appeared in the book have, you know, pointed out many, many times all the minor details they think I got wrong.
But that's not really the point, I suppose.
Well, that's what my opinion is, yeah.
So screw them.
Exactly. Should be thankful to be in the book, Alex Robinson.
Let's not bring this all out again. I guess the one last thing that I wanted to sort of touch on in the book is that, you know, you're drawing yourself over and over in this book, and so you had to come up with a visual representation of yourself.
Yeah.
And what you have a giant round head and big teeth and a really, like, you're very exaggerated. Like, I know what you look like. You look kind of like this, but this is not what I would call a flattering depiction of yourself.
No, actually, it hurts my feelings when people go, oh, you really captured yourself in the book. That protruding brow and gigantic teeth.
I mean, did that come from, like, is that how you'd always sort of drawn, I guess, a caricature of yourself or, you know...
I developed it in the story. My early pages, I didn't look like that, but then I came up with this thing that I thought was funny and I thought was an appealing caricature. Mm-hmm. And I do think it actually does look like me, just maybe not, I'm not quite as grotesque as that. And there's also a funny thing that emerged from it. This wasn't conscious, was that people like my wife, my mother, my sister, all the girls in my life were not pleased with the way they were represented. But I feel that nobody can complain because I clearly look the worst of everybody.
It's strategic in that way.
It is, because Elisa, my wife, does not like how I drew her, but you know, she doesn't look like this, you know, grotesque mongoloid thing that I drew myself.
It's better that way.
I mean, anyway, I also just think it's funny. I mean, I hope that the book is funny. I think it's kind of a blend, yeah, of humor and sincerity. But you know, it really was supposed to be, you know, definitely have a humorous side to it. The whole point of it is supposed to be a little bit funny.
No, it is, it's in that way that, I mean, you're sort of making fun of yourself as a kid.
Because yeah,
as a kid, you kind of overdo everything just a little bit, and it's a neat, I don't need to sit here and compliment you, but it's a neat...
What else is good about it?
It's a neat framework for what that is. And I mean, yeah, in that way, it's not really just, here's me obsessed with Queen. It's really like one of those, everybody's got their adolescent story and that whole thing growing up.
Yeah.
I thought that's what I related to.
Well, I found that people can just relate to that feeling about obsessing with pop culture as well. Like how you would feel if you wrote a book about Star Wars.
Which I wouldn't do.
Because then you would discover that you are not the biggest Star Wars.
I'm probably like a 3.
Oh, really? You're downgrading yourself that much?
I might be. I don't want to know, basically, is my point.
Well, the 1 would be like the person in high school I know who'd only ever seen Spaceballs and had never seen Star Wars.
That's where they do rate still, because they kind of get the cultural...
Because they're familiar with, like, when they actually sat down to watch Star Wars. They're like, oh, that's like that part in Spaceballs.
those are horrible people. Well, let's go backwards. You'd mentioned Gabagool, which I guess was sort of the first thing that was it the first project that you sort of worked regularly on, put issues out, things like that?
Yes, that was when I first was throwing myself fully into you know, the independent comics scene, such as it is in the United States. It's actually pretty big. You know, there's a lot of conventions across the country. There's a fairly large community. And I was working on this comic with, as I said, with the humorist Chris Radke. And we did that for 6 issues, and it was fairly well received, and it was actually a really great experience. I recently posted all 6 issues on my website, so since they're not published by anybody, people can check them out there. The whole thing's there, though some of it is NSFW. I must warn.
Who? Don't use web acronyms in actual speaking time. LOL. So what is Gabagool? This is one of those titles that I remember, like, I don't remember where, but like, it's always been that sound in the background that I know that there was a book somewhere called that, but I never really knew what it was. What is it, and why is it called that?
Gabagool is about Christopher Vigliotti is the protagonist, and he lives in the Bronx. In his cousin's, he lives in his cousin's building, and it's sort of it's about him and his roommates, and they're sort of, you know, slackers, nerds. The first 3 issues deals with them sort of being sick of what they do as their day job, so they decide to become bounty hunters for hire. So the couple of issues are dealing with them and the jobs that they get, and the last 3 issues deal with them going on vacation in Jamaica. But the whole Gabagool thing is about, you know, they're Italian-American. Chris, the co-writer, is Italian-American, so it's a lot of it based on his experience and people he knew, mm-hmm, you know, from Long Island and the Bronx. So it's very, very set in a specific place and time.
Now, how much, because you did all the art, and you co-wrote it, correct?
Yep.
So, like, did you guys work up scripts together? Did you sort of work, I guess, you know, like plot style, and then you draw it out and...
That was a very different writing experience. We would sit down, and it would be like through conversation generating a script. I'd sit there with a notebook, and we'd just write it out. We'd actually write out full issues, and then I would go and draw it. So very much different from the way I work when I'm by myself, but really very positive. Mm-hmm. And it really does sort of drive home this idea that collaboration, you know, really does enable you to do the type of things you could not do by yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, collaboration is very positive in that way, because you know, you're going to come up with things that it would be impossible for you to write or draw, you know, alone.
Do you think it was good for you in the sense of, I imagine it'd be good that, especially when you're starting out and you're just going to commit yourself to do something, it's harder to abandon a project if you're working on it with somebody. So it sort of keeps you going, you know?
I mean, it's definitely good because we got momentum going. We, you know, we'd have a great time at conventions. Chris was great at selling copies of it to people. He was very persuasive. In fact, he developed a reputation for a little while there for being so persuasive. Sort of been able to grab people as they walk past the table, reel them in and sell them some books, you know, which is a good thing. I mean, it can be grating to some people, but it's just, you know, we believe in the comic. The comic is good, and, you know, you want people to check it out. And almost always people had a positive reaction to it.
It's the indie comics experience.
Yes. Well, the alternative I found is to sit there with sort of a sad, forlorn look on your face behind the table and just hope someone takes pity on you.
I thought we weren't going to talk about Alex Robinson.
That's, well, you know, it works okay. You sit there with your sad cow eyes.
it'd be a good time, I guess, to mention that you do a podcast with the aforementioned Alex.
Yes, that's why I keep bringing him up.
You two are friends. He's
not actually like my nemesis in comics.
That's why it's okay to poke little bits of fun at him.
Yes, we have a show called The Ink Panther Show, and you've been on.
I have. That makes me a very biased interviewer, but full disclosure, yeah. And it's interesting because you are two cartoonists, and you decided not to talk about any comics or cartooning of any way, although you've did
it. It definitely leaks in. I just think that's for us, mm-hmm. because we can't talk about just our own comics every episode. I think it gives us more of a chance of having a little bit of longevity if we if we have a broader range of things to discuss.
So why did you decide to start doing a podcast? Just, you know, you guys wanted to chat and whatever.
Well, I guess the idea has sort of been batted about from time to time. You know, I mean, we think we're funny. You know, so I guess we thought maybe we could, you know, sustain a podcast, which is just us in conversation. Mm-hmm. We used to get together on a very frequent basis to buy comics and have dinner, and it was sort of like a standing date, little mandate that we would have on sort of a weekly basis. And it was happening a lot less once my daughter showed up. She was 18 years old. I didn't know that she existed. But I'm just kidding. Haha.
I'm doing the math on that. And
no, so we had a baby, and I just, you know, that tends to make it so it's a little more difficult to maintain, you know, social arrangements. So we kind of just, I don't know if that's the conscious reason we decided to do it, but I kind of feel like we've replaced our weekly sit down at the Irish pub and chat with now a weekly sit down on the computer and talk over the Skype. You know, and then have everyone listen to what we said.
It's not really that different than why our podcast started, really. I mean, it's the same thing. Like, my two friends lived on the East Coast and I lived on the West Coast. And this was, you know, a way for us to do it.
Did you talk about comics with those friends
all the time? Yeah, that was our thing. That was our shared experience. And, you know, our whole show and basically everything, you know, that became my career then, you know, for 2 years came out of it. So
in the early days, before you had the podcast, you guys would go to dinner. And then you'd sit, you know, you'd each take a turn. You go, pick of the week. And you'd be like, this is it. And
no, that's not. Yes, that's exactly what happened. No, we'd been doing the website forever. And we did the pick of the week on there. And it was just like our thing.
Oh, you do that in conversation. You'd have pick of the week.
we couldn't go on to the main course until one of us had chosen the best book.
Yes.
We won't do this any further. But, you know, it's a funny show, and I've tried to make sure that people listen to it when they can, and you guys, it's funny, you know, because it's one of those things in podcasting, listening to somebody talk or listening to two people talk together is not always interesting, but good shows stand out, and I will walk down the street, and I will laugh very frequently at listening to the two of you.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I guess it's the same sort of idea what I was talking about before, you know, that depending on how you say things, it could be interesting, you know.
I think the show is about the ineffectual nature of the modern man. That's what I
kind of actually, that is a constant theme, is about how Alex and I don't feel like real men.
I don't want to do that because it makes me uncomfortable, or I don't think I'm up to it.
That's how we, that's basically what we're talking about all the time. How we feel lost when we go into a Home Depot, you know? Yes. We got to get that out. You know, I got to stop talking about that.
Hey, if that's what it is, that's what it is. There's nothing you can do about it. So make sure you check out the Ink Panther show.
I'm going to change the topics to how I'm winning all these arm wrestling matches. That's going to be my topic every week.
Don't change the working formula is what I'm saying to you.
Okay, all right.
It's nothing. That's not a good idea. So moving on to stuff that's going on now, you have a book out from Ad House.
Yes, it just came out a couple months ago.
Ace Face, the mod with the metal arms. Again, I'm going to defer to you to explain what this is.
You know, it actually sort of is the same as the Ink Panther show in that it's me obsessing on feelings of masculinity and manhood, but in a funny way, because Ace Face is a superhero character that I've had for a number of years. He was born without arms. He happened to have a scientist uncle who built him a robot pair of arms. It was funny when he was little because they were adult-sized robot arms that he had to grow into, so he looked ridiculous the first couple years of his life. But all the stories really are about comic book violence, like, you know, the way how things happen in the comics sort of contrasted against sort of how confrontation happens in real life. So some of them are him encountering, like, comic book type of battles, and then some of them are more like slice-of-life contrasts against, you know, what things are really like when you get into confrontations with people.
And then in the middle of the, you know, it sort of alternates, there's little sort of vignettes, little stories, and there's the Jack and Mac stories in here too, which are, you're also currently sort of self-publishing on the web.
Yeah.
At the same time, which I guess these are two kids with superpowers.
Yeah, so this
who are constantly fighting.
Yeah, so this again is sort of was me thinking. It's a lot of it is me, and I hope I don't make it sound like it's not funny because most of the stories are actually pretty funny. I think in Ace Face they're supposed to be.
Yes.
But it was again like I was thinking about the concept of Power Pack, mm-hmm. and you know the Marvel comic book from the 80s and 90s, and it was like four little kids, siblings who all had powers, and they fought together as a team, like against, you know, foes and threats. But I was thinking about how in reality siblings, if they had superpowers, would just be using those powers to knock the crap out of each other and destroy the house. And, you know, especially like these are two boys, you know, one's a third grader, one's a fifth grader, they're brothers, and they're just constantly, you know, antagonizing each other, wrestling, and then destroying things with their powers.
Were you doing these stories, I mean, were you just posting these on your website and then put them together in a book? Because it's sort of a little anthology. I mean, I know they're all sort of loosely connected, but there's, you know, there's stuff in here about, there's the Ace Face stories, then there's the Jack and Max stories, there's a story about your loud neighbors, which I've heard about on the podcast.
No, those are that's a fictional story.
Sure.
About Ace Face's son, who lives in Park Slope and has loud neighbors.
That remarably parallels one in real life.
It looks exactly like my life. I don't know. I didn't want to come off all, you know, like I'm into gentrifying neighborhoods and stuff like that. I don't know. It's sort of you're running a fine line when it comes to New York City politics when I'm complaining about, you know, living in yuppie Park Slope and how loud thugs are hanging out in the stoop, ruining it for us yuppies with our baby joggers. Listen to the Ink Panther show if you want to hear me complain about that more.
I believe episode 1 and 2 are the...
Yeah, the early ones. I guess I was in the throes of the whole situation. I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, these... I was asking, like, this is like an anthology. Was this stuff that you... Were you publishing all this stuff on the web and then brought it to Ad House to sell sort of as a complete thing, or?
So two of the Ace Face stories had appeared previously in Ad House anthologies, Project Superior and the spin-off series that came out of that called Superior Showcase. So I had some Ace Face stories, I had ideas for other stories, and then I was doing short stories to just post on my website. I kind of had spent 4 years working on Freddie and Me. And I was just trying to take a bit of a breather and just do short stories that I could put up on the web rather than diving right into another book that was going to take me 4 years, you know, to finish. Mm-hmm. So I had the Jack and Max material completed. I had the Ace Face material completed. A few other things were already done when I went to Ad House and proposed doing this sort of Ace Face anthology, which he was open to, thankfully. So then I generated some new material for the book. Well, a lot of new material for the book after that.
Yeah, and it's a fun little book. Like I find it very difficult to describe because there's sort of a lot in here. But it's sort of like a little anthology of Mike Dawson comics, really.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, well, it is. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. It's really the only the connection is that theme of sort of, you know, violence mm-hmm. and fighting, because a lot of the stories are sort of a little different from each other. Sort of the tone is a little different. You know, the Jack and Max ones are kind of over the top, you know, and then this stuff about Ace faces son in air quotes, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, like a different style of cartooning.
Yeah. And yeah, that's always interesting. Now these are, and it's only like a, it's like a $7 book. It's not.
Actually, it's on sale at the publisher's website for $4.95 and it's 100 pages. So I wish everybody who listens to the show would buy a copy.
Well, it's $7. I even felt like I got something fun out of it. So it's one of those things that like, it's odd. I'm not gonna tell you it's not odd, because what you've got is the mod with the metal arms. You know, if Americans don't know what a mod is or any of that stuff, like I find it, you know, I was like I said, I was a Who fan, so I was like, this is the oddest thing ever. But
were you disappointed because you thought it'd be more of that? Like it'd be a bit more?
No, I think there was just enough.
Okay.
If I'm being honest.
Okay.
But it was, you know, it's just like, it's one of those things like, you know, nerdy American comic writers have a thing for British society, I think, a little bit. They're Anglophiles. They know what Monty Python is. They know all that stuff. So I think to read the stuff in the beginning, it's just sort of one of those interesting things. It wasn't like anything else, I guess.
Now, well, I think that's good in theory. It is terrible when I sit at a table trying to sell it.
I can see that. I have no idea how you got this published, but it's good is the point. It is difficult to explain. So apparently you're not at all commercial, and in that way, you're perfect for indie comics.
Actually, I would say, I don't think it's been a commercial success. I think
now you also work with, now you post stuff on your website and then you also do stuff with Activate, or is it the same stuff? Can you explain to me what Activate is? I'm hearing a lot more about this, and I know that the Activate Primer just came out, which is an anthology of all the Activate stuff.
Yes, I have a story in that.
Okay.
It is a Jack and Max story. It's called Goodnight Max, and it's sort of a little bit of a takeoff of the children's book Goodnight Moon, which I'm sure you, Josh, will become familiar with in a couple months when your baby arrives, because I imagine you're going to get it as a gift. I'm not sure. Are you able to talk about your baby on the show?
Yes, I am.
Edit that out. Okay.
No.
You probably will get it as a gift when the baby arrives, and it's a good book. But anyway, so I have a short story in there. I tried to sort of mimic the style of that book.
So what is Activate?
Activate is a web comics, and insist I'm doing it on writing comics with an X. So for their sake, imagine that I'm saying it with an X right now, because it's a web comics collective. It's mostly a group of New York, Brooklyn-based cartoonists. They post a number of ongoing serialized strips. A number of different strips get posted every day. Mostly people are writing like long-form graphic novel type books up on the web for people to read.
For free.
And I had been writing a story called Jack and Max Escape from the End of Time. I took the characters from those two short stories that are in the Ace Face collection and was working on and I'm still working on a long form story with them. Mm-hmm. And yep.
Now I guess it's interesting because, you know, in a way independent comics have come around where before you had to be at all the different shows, and there are hundreds of them now, it seems like, and you're self-publishing and doing stuff. But now, you know, you guys are putting up all of your stuff on the web for free.
Yeah.
What do you think about that as a method of getting your work out there? Do you worry that maybe it's cannibalizing any sales you could have gotten, or do you think I assume you've decided it's better in the long run to...
I think from my perspective, and I bet that a lot of web cartoonists probably sort of share this perspective, prior to posting stuff on the web, a lot of us would have been self-publishing our comics at Kinko's. Mm-hmm. And that normally meant that you paid money. You know, you try to recoup some of it at shows, and you would, but usually self-publishing is sort of it doesn't put you in the black. It keeps you in the red. Mm-hmm. So really, you're actually breaking even by putting it up on the web, because at least you're not spending any money to publish it, and you're reaching a much larger audience. Mm-hmm. And when I go to these shows now, like SPX, and I was at TCAF this last year, That's the one in Toronto, which is a fantastic comic book convention. You can really see that the people who are putting webcomics out are becoming the new sort of it people of these shows. They've got really big audiences now, big dedicated audiences. And it's probably, you know, I'm sure that this is the same percentage of people who put up good stuff and are successful against people who don't make successful webcomics exists the same way it did in self-published comics. Because there's probably even more people on the web now than there are self-publishing. But in terms of just being a cost-effective way to reach a large amount of people, it's fantastic. I think there's a big drawback just in that I think that especially arts comics people are kind of bibliophile, tactile type people who want to buy books. So that's good and bad because I know I personally don't love reading webcomics because I like to own comics. I like books. But I guess it works well for the web cartoonist who then publishes a collection of his webcomics because then they have an audience. And like I've seen people who are like, you know, the rock stars of these shows and they've self-published, something that they've had up online for free and they sell out within hours. Like, have you heard of Kate Beaton?
No.
She's really kind of like the buzzed about cartoonists at a lot of these shows this last year. And I'd never heard of her until I went to Toronto, but now I hear about her all the time. She's a really good cartoonist. Does an online comic called Hark! A Vagrant.
Okay.
But check it out. It's funny. It's a historical comic strips.
What, like, that silence there was not indifference, but the inability to come up with a joke after hearing Hark! A Vagrant. I was like, there's something there, but the gears froze and I didn't have anything and I ended up sounding silent.
Stupid thing to say on the show. Hark! A Vagrant. Why'd I invite this guy on?
No. Now, when you're talking about making comics, now you, like you said, you have a small daughter,
yeah,
a young daughter, and you still have a day job some of the time. So not to break the myth or anything like that, but at the same time, you're still making comics.
Yep.
Like how disciplined do you have to be? Do you have a schedule, a specific, you know, you have to do a certain amount of stuff every week to make yourself feel good, or
To make myself feel
good.
How
do you stay on task, I guess?
This isn't all a vanity exercise. It's not just about making me feel good. I do have a minimum number of pages which I try to draw in a week, which is 2. So it's not like that ambitious. But that's also why Freddie and Me took me so long, because I had a day job then as well. Now it's even rougher because I've got the baby. And she's getting to be more of a handful every day because now she's walking around and closing doors and getting into things. Closing doors on me, shutting me out of rooms. But yeah, I mean, we have daycare.
Right.
And I do, you know, and I do work at night still, and I'm still able to get work done. So it does take a lot of me being pretty driven. Mm-hmm. It also means I don't have a great social life. I don't. I mean, I have a lot of people I know in comics, but I don't go out a lot. Mm-hmm. That's just the fact of it. So that has a lot to do with me having a baby and me just sort of having the urge to get pages drawn rather than go out.
And I mean, where do you think that, where does that urge come from? You just want to finish the thing you're doing? You just constantly want to create stuff? Or, I mean, where do you find that motivation, I guess?
I think because being a professional, quote unquote, alternative style cartoonist is definitely an uphill battle. Mm-hmm. I mean, my goal would be to, you know, not to be famous, not to be the most successful one, but just to make a living doing it. Mm-hmm. Like something where I can, you know, that could be what I do. But that is actually, you know, a massive challenge into itself. And I'm, you know, I've had good things happen, you know, in terms of getting things published and stuff like that. But even now, it's not like something's published, you're done.
You're also not 24.
No, I'm not. And I definitely have a wife who has a standard of living to which she's accustomed, you know.
And you have nothing to do with it. No.
No, I have just...
I could live in a box. I don't care. It's interesting, though. Because, do you think...
I think I got more driven after I got married, actually.
Sure.
When those constraints were put on me. Mm-hmm. I think that when I was single and actually was living practically in a box, you know, I lived in an apartment in the city where I didn't have a kitchen in my apartment. And I was sharing it with somebody. We just had a curtain between our areas of the apartment, you know. So it was like a nest. It's like I had a little nest that I would bring girls back to. Ladies. I would bring ladies back there.
That makes them sound like hookers.
I mean, ladies of the night. And I would, don't worry, that curtain's pretty soundproof. So when I got married and I felt like I was more pressure was put on me to, you know, to be able to support myself, you know, at a day job, you know, that I'd take seriously and, you know, do well at and, you know, and to put my family in on that stuff, you know, up there with my comics, can't leave them ahead of everybody, though I'd love to. Oh, I'd love to put my comics first.
Do you think it is it?
I hope everyone can tell I'm joking a little bit.
You're being a little too dry. He may not sound British, but he's got the dry British wit and he'll fool you. He's like, my God, he's an asshole. No,
he would give up his wife for a comic book.
Do you think, I mean, as a guy who's sort of on the bubble, you've had professional success with it, but it's difficult, you know, it's difficult to make a full-time living with making comics. Do you think is it a good time for that? Or is the industry in such a way that...
You mean like right now?
Yeah.
I think the last year has clearly been rocky. I think that there was a great sort of expansion in publishing, especially in graphic novels. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I think I had my book coming out just at the right time to benefit from that. You know, not to diminish the quality of my book, I think it's a good book, but I think, you know, there was a wider choice of publishers, you know, to go to. Mm-hmm. You know, there was more opportunity, and this was two, three years ago, when I actually got the deal, because the book didn't come out for like a year or so after. I think it's definitely contracted with the publishing industry, is having a lot of problems.
Such a short window of like, the graphic novel success boom. Like, it was... And then all of a sudden the economy collapses and it gets to be like, oh, and yeah, publishing's hurting already.
Well, I think that, I don't know this because I don't have publishers explain to me what's going on. My outsider's perspective is that there are still graphic novels that are successful. I think that they may be veering slightly towards the YA, young adult audience type graphic novels. That the literary graphic novel, the adult one, is struggling a little. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the kids one is like. I actually, like, kids graphic novels come out and I never hear anything about them or don't even realize they're out. And then I eventually will come across them, but it's like, it's a whole different industry that I'm not even aware of. So I have no idea how well those are doing. Like, they'll come out from big publishers, but they don't seem to be like getting into the sort of mainstream comics press and, you know, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I know I do. Well, I think it's that. I don't know. The audience is kind of split about them. I think the audience, the mainstream comics audience, aren't really interested in kids' books so much, so they don't tend to talk about them. Although I think it's changing a little bit because they're older. You know, the comics audience isn't as young as, and I think there's a lot of people who want to be able to pass on comics to their kids.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a market for that. So, but like
I was sitting with my daughter the other day. I was reading her Kramer's Ergo number 7 number 6. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was funny because, you know, it was this little section where it was all these like lovely, beautifully rendered drawings of like women urinating on people. And it's funny. My daughter is too young to actually, you know, get disturbed by it. You know, she sees a pretty picture, but my wife did not think it was funny. She didn't think it was funny that I was doing that.
I was thinking that was a problem as you were explaining it to me.
What? His wife wouldn't think that was funny.
But even like Jack and Max, I mean, they're kids, but it's not like a kid's.
Well, that one I'm trying to write something that appeals to kids and to adults.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely got that flavor of somebody who's read Marvel Comics.
I mean, it's not going to appeal to adults who don't think it's funny that kids act obnoxiously and, you know, violently. If you're an adult who thinks that's funny and, you know, remembers his or own childhood, you know, somewhat accurately, then you would be okay with it. And kids think it's funny. I mean, the one of the first scenes is all about the one brother giving the other brother Dutch ovens.
But he teleports.
Yes, he does. He uses his powers to teleport under the blankets to Dutch oven his brother. You know, so this is not highbrow. This is
it's not, but it's lovely in its way. All right. Is there anything else that I think we covered damn near everything?
Yes. Thank you very much for having me on just to ramble.
No problem at all. It's glad to have you.
So you're gonna come on the Ink Panther show again.
I'd love to. I almost it's funny, I almost feel intimidated. You guys have a vibe.
Well, you have a vibe on your show.
Yeah, I know. But you have a thing, and I'm in there and making fun of people from New Jersey. That was a mistake.
Oh, you've regretted all the things you said on the show.
I might have. I got too comfortable. I forgot that there were people out there. So what's your website?
It is MikeDawsonComics.com.
And you are on Twitter?
That is a URL I despise, but I have a very common name, so I can't just be MikeDawson.com. So I sort of feel married to this Mike Dawson Comics.
I became J.A. Flanagan for that same reason.
You have a common name?
There's a Josh Flanagan out there, and he's like a programmer, and he got the URL years and years and years ago.
You know, I think the Mike Dawson out there with the URL is a programmer as well. Because they're the ones who landed those URLs way ahead of the rest of us.
We need to find these guys.
Jerks, he's wasting it on a nothing site. You know, it's like his professional resume site or something.
I do come up first for my name in Google, though.
Okay, that is good.
So I got that going for me.
Good.
Awesome.
Congratulations, right, J.A. Flanagan.
Thank you very much. I thought it was a nice author name. Like, if I ever put out a book, it would look good on, like, you know, next to D.A. whoever.
Hughley.
Yeah. D.L. Hughley's book. Of course.
I would look good next to each other.
I would have no problem with putting my book next to D.L. Hughley's book.
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
Both look very, like, authorly.
Letters are letter for men of letters. It makes perfect sense. All right, I'll see you later.
Thank you, Josh.
I want to thank Mike for hanging out with us and apologize to him for the music choice. Anyway, you can read all about everything Mike's doing at MikeDawsonComics.com. Make sure to listen to the Ink Panthers podcast. You can find that on iTunes. And make sure to check out his many good books, and want to thank him a lot. Get to ifanboy.com to talk about this show and look at all the other stuff we got going on there. Thanks very much.